do not worship. They are not considered even to be a church. It is a beautiful city. Many artists go there because there are so many colors in the brick and the landscape. As you can see, these are ancient bridges which were not destroyed in World War II. Very few bridges survived the Allied bombings. We were there for about a day or so, a day, I believe, and it's very interesting and very ancient. This is the cathedral that was built whenever the Albigenses were gaining strength, and finally some of the aristocracy and the people who were in line to be king of France, princes, many of them converted to the Albigensian religion. And in order to thwart the spread of the Albi belief, which is substantially what the Waldensians were, they had a lot of contact. These are in southern France, just a few miles from the Pyrenees Mountains. Waldenses, of course, were in northern Italy. But it was not that far. So they had contact with one another. In fact, we don't know perhaps who started whom for who was first, the Albigenses or the Waldenses, but we do know they were substantially believers in the same doctrines. The Catholic Church decided that in order to show the people that were on God's side, that it was best for them to build this huge cathedral. And it took many years, and it was made from a pink brick. And this is the only brick cathedral in all of France or England. I think there are some in France and Italy, but I think there are some in England. You can see they got to certain mining areas for the brick, and it changed color on them, but they finished it. This took the lives of many, many people to build this. They thought if we build this huge, massive cathedral, it'll prove that God is on our side, because the Albigenses worshiped in little buildings or in their homes or even out in the open under trees or something of that nature. They didn't have large, elaborate churches. They were just mostly villages, and they had no area that they considered a headquarters where they built massive buildings or anything of that nature. So this was built to convince people that they ought to get with the winners. And the winners were the ones who could build the biggest buildings and the ones who could decorate it the best. Every cathedral has to have a relic. That relic can be some of Mary's hair. It can be some of Peter's, St. Peter. It could be his knuckles or his fingernail. I could give you a long list of all of the relics that are in the cathedrals in Europe, and it would take several pages in a book. Someone estimated that the hair that's on display in the different cathedrals that belonged to Jesus, belonged to Mary, belonged to one of the apostles, that just to Mary, she would have had to have had a head of hair that was over 40 pounds. So, but this is where they had a relic in the cathedral, which is very elaborate, and it's a part of their claim to being the true church, that they actually have some relic. And the most expensive relic is a splinter or a piece of the cross. So you can see that this actually was sold by merchants from the east, from Jerusalem, and it too would have had to weigh 400 or 500 pounds when you consider all of the splinters that came off of it. And this is where the choir sat on either side, and someone in this little square toward the middle is where the preacher stood, who addressed the choir, or rather directed the choir. And then there's the altar where they changed the body and blood of Jesus, body, and they changed the wine and the bread into the body and blood of Jesus. And you can see how elaborate it is. It is unbelievable. Very expensive artwork, and the acoustics in this area are very, very fine. Now, they would put a blind or separate this from the other part, and while they were having their services, this choir then was singing, but they were unseen. So, and the people that they put on trial to see if they were heretics, the judges sat on these benches, three-tiered benches, and he stood in the middle, or if he was very old or very weak, they'd let him sit on a chair. And here's where they questioned him and ultimately passed judgment on his faith. This is about 1,100 years old, and it's a garden where the priests and the archbishop strolled meditating. And you think of how they enjoyed, or how much they placed into beauty in nature, and then how they didn't respect the human heart and the human soul. And that's really a contradiction to me. This is the old part of the first cathedral. You can see how rough it is over there, just cut stone, not beautiful at all. And they just built this cathedral around it, and that's the only parts that you can really see now, just to impress people. And many people today believe that the most prosperous congregation is the one that God is blessing. Sometimes you remember that the devil blesses his people, and sometimes more than God blesses his people, because God is not into show. God is into sincerity and simplicity. Now, this is in the cathedral. Can any of you see what this presents? That's right. There are flames there, and there's a person who's being burned. And this is an Albigensian, and this was in 1209, okay? In 1203, Pope Innocent III became the Pope of Rome. And as such, he immediately ordered that all the Albigenses be punished and brought back into the church fold. And this is a part of a glass drawing that was made, or an etching in glass, I should say. This is their presentation of an Albi preacher. See how dark and foreboding and threatening he seems to be? And that was also in the cathedral. This is what you see traveling around southern France. There are castles on many, many of the hills or mountains. Most of them are unoccupied at this particular time. But we're going to look at the struggle that occurred between the Albigensian preachers and the priests who came in to southern France to convince them of their error. These priests came among them and argued scripture. It wasn't long until the priests learned that's not a good idea, because they were constantly amazed at how much the Albigensians knew about their Bible. And so Pope Innocent sent Dominic, who was a well-educated and very personable person, sent him to study what was happening. Why can these peasants, poor people, and some very wealthy and influential people, why are they turning away from the Catholic Church to just a very personal and private relationship with God, without the belief in the Eucharist and all the other six sacraments that they had instituted? So Dominic came in and looked around, and of course the priests were wearing very expensive robes and eating very expensive food, living in the very best places they could. So Dominic's decided that the best way to approach this would be to go in barefooted and wearing just a robe and having your hair cut short in a particular way that identified you as a priest. So this is the, can you imagine what this says? 1206 to 1213. It's his what? Can you see it, kids? What's it say? The habitat? What would a habitat be? Yeah, it's where he lived, wasn't it? From 1206 to 1213. And he was the founder of the Dominican priest. Here was a test that was, I think, perhaps the most interesting I've ever heard of. But Dominic was to bring his Bible, and one of the Albi preachers was to bring his Bible, and they would each lay their Bibles on this fire. And whoever was preaching falsely, their Bible would burn up. When Dominic laid his Bible on the fire, it flew off so fast and went so high into the building that it caused a big dent in one of the arches. Y'all all believe that? Raise your hands, please. Well, that's the story that was told about this contest between the true preachers and the false preachers. There was a lot of warfare. This is an artist's concept of castles being besieged, because people who lived in these castles were actually Albigenses, and it had to be stopped. The person who was the general behind all of this was Simon de Montfort, and he's recognized in European history as a great general. So he was the man who carried his sword. If that sword had a rose on it, it meant that it had been blessed by the Pope for the carrying out of the execution of the Albigensian people. What happened when these people, in about 1220, the persecution really began to fall upon them? Their farms were confiscated, their houses were confiscated, and they literally had no home. And if you took them in, or if you were an attorney and represented them before the courts, then the attorney, if he lost his case, was persecuted with them. If he won his case, he was probably put to death. So there was just no recourse. And so these people, after wandering for a long period of time, finally came into this destitute circumstance. And here's how their houses were treated and how the people were just set adrift. And this is the Inquisition. Pope Innocent set up the first inquisitor, called the Holy Inquisitor, and the concept of Inquisition. This man that's seated, you can see him with a wig on, he's the inquisitor. Here's the man with his hands tied behind his back whom he's inquiring of. And the person in the black robe is playing the devil's advocate. That is, he's the one who will tell this person, you're not telling the truth. And you'll notice that he has tongs and all kinds of equipment for torturing this person. And so the Holy Inquisitor had more power than any person that lived on the earth other than the Pope himself. Kings, anyone that was suspected of heresy could be brought before the Inquisitor, and his decision was final. And what he did was decide that he had committed heresy, and heresy is punishable by death. So then the civil authorities would come in and carry out the decision of the Inquisitor. The office of the Holy Inquisitor existed in some places well into the 17th century. Here's a particular kind of punishment, that is to be hung up by one of your arms, a weight tied to your feet, and this simply pulled your arm out of its socket. Any of you ever dislocated a shoulder, you know how painful that is. And they left you hanging there until you confessed that you were a heretic, even if you weren't. You'll see the people who are guarding him or waiting for his confession are so unconcerned about this man's pain that they're playing cards over in the corner. And there are people coming in the door watching this person as he is punished, trying to get a confession from him. You see a rack where that little four-pronged wheel is there. So all this punishment was carried on in this building. And the people who were out for a stroll in the city would simply stop in for a little while and watch the proceedings to see what was going on and take, you know, watch a little television, I guess, and take the cares of life off their mind. You wonder why we really have so little information about this. I have a book that was actually records that were taken from the little villages of Albi, and it's Pope Innocent III is the name of the book, and all that happened. And we don't have a written history, that is, we who are Baptist people, dissenters, because they burned our books. Every time they found that a man was a heretic, they went into his family, who did not say that they were not punished, but they perhaps burned all their books, confiscated their property. So there's no way that we could have kept a record from the 1200s into the 1400s because they burned our books. Prison sentence was the same as a death sentence. The conditions were so poor that after 3 to 6 months, there rarely ever was a survivor. There was no produce the witness or the accused. They could leave you in prison a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years without ever having a trial. And that's how they treated the people who generally were not convicted. They just simply left them in prison until they died or became so weak that they knew they could not really do anything anymore. This man is going to be burned at the on a great a pile of brush and being tied to a stake. His name is Hans Brett. And they learned that when they burned people or when they were torturing people, that the people oftentimes would give a witness. And this oftentimes really had great power and influence. So they're going to put a device on his tongue that will keep him from witnessing. Now, they did it sometimes, just pull the tongue out as far as they could with a blacksmith's tool and just cut it off. But the bloody cavity was so obvious that it really made people angry. Well, sometimes they just split the tongue. Or sometimes they would burn it severely in the evening before they were going to be put to death, so that the tongue swelled up in their mouth and they couldn't speak. But this man is getting a device that fastened on his tongue that was saved from the place where he was burned to death, and they actually have it in a museum in Amsterdam now. And that's this tongue screw. They put your tongue in here, turn the screw so tight that you couldn't speak, and when he burned, of course, some of the people who were his loved ones went and salvaged this, and it's been kept in the family ever since. Here's another horrible way to die. Put you on a ladder and then shove you over into a real intense fire. Now, none of these are just made up, okay? These are people who had names. They were people who lived. And all of these were recorded generally in village books or in a city book as an execution. So we really know how they died and what their names were and what happened to them in many cases. This is not a catapult, it's a trebuchet. It's what they used in an attack against a village or against a castle of persons suspected of being an Albigensian. And these were the hewn balls that they used for ammunition, huge ones and smaller ones. And they were very effective in knocking down walls and getting the people where they could not defend themselves. This is Montségur. This is where the last massacre of the Albigenses took place. They hounded them and hunted them until they finally came here as the final refuge. Many, many stories are told about this area and about Montségur. One of the stories told is that they had the chalice from which Jesus drank wine in the Last Supper. And they believe that the Albigenses some way had hooked into contacts that actually Mary had come and lived in this area and brought it with her. And so this whole area is just, the caves and all are dug in, and it's amazing what people are still today searching for the chalice that was supposed to have been hidden by these Albigenses. Another thing that might be interesting to you is this place is the place where crystals, and many of them come from Hot Springs area. This is where the karma is for all the world. You can go here with your crystal, some small ones, some big ones, and here you can find power. And so there are people who come from all over the world into this area, either to dig for the chalice or to have their crystals blessed. So it's still an active place, although very few people live in the area. This is near the dark evening sunset when I was there, I believe in 75. But some of our people who were on this trip with me went up to Montségur and climbed it. Very, very foggy, Janet and RJ. And this is the monument that's built to those people who made this their final home, not their final stand. It was just that they went there and they couldn't be dislodged very easily, so they lay siege to it. That is, they just said, they're up there, we'll put soldiers around it, and ultimately they're going to starve to death or they're going to come down and surrender. This is Carcassonne, where all of the judgments, all of the soldiers were given their orders. Many of them were brought back to this place. Now, what happened at this place that's marked with this monument is there were 153 men, see different figures, men, women, whoever, that were there. And I'd heard different stories until finally I read in a history book that they built a huge fire near this place. I'm not talking about just a small, but I'm talking about it was massive. And they took half of the people and chained them together on one side of this great fire, and they chained the other half together. Then they run a chain across, and they were going to see these people pull against one another, so that in a tug of war, so called, until they pull one side into the fire. And that was going to prove that these people didn't have anything different from what everyone else had in this world. You know how they solved the problem? They all, at a given moment, all of them just walked into the fire. Rather than pull their brothers or sisters into the fire, they just said, it's over. So they all just marched into it. And that took away the plan that they had of making this a story of how weak these people were when they really got in a jam. They'll turn on each other, and they'll try to save their lives above everything else. But that is the place or reason for this monument. As I said, here's the best preserved castle and fortress in all of Europe. It is a small village or town called Carcassonne, and it's two-tiered. They had two walls, which made it extremely safe. They had to breach one wall and then breach another wall at the same time. Soldiers could rush around anywhere and defend this first wall. So it was a safe place, but it was also a place where people were brought to trial. You go down into this area, into the dungeon, literally, you're going to find the torture devices still there that were used in the 1200s and 1100s. Once a year, they open all of this up, and if you want to, you can go down into this dungeon area and see the torture chambers. I haven't been there at that particular time, but there are many people who make it a point to come there and to see this. Religious people who see the torture of God's people and are interested in it. But this is the most visited castle in Europe. When you go there, especially about any time of the year, you're going to see people from Japan and so many other places, because this is on the tour circuit. First time I went, it was just very calm, didn't see anybody else. The people were sitting in little outdoor cafes, sipping coffee or whatever, and little shops here and there. And people actually lived within the walls of this place. And they had a drawbridge. They drove their cars across in the evening or whatever. But the last time I went, it was changed dramatically. The Baptists were not the only people that were persecuted for their religion. After the Reformation, a group of people arose who were Calvinists. Some of them were called Huguenots. And no, they weren't named after Victor Hugo, an author of in the much later period. But the word Huguenot was the word that described a coin that was worth like a fourth of a cent. It wasn't even worth picking up off of the street. And so they named these people Huguenots because they were a worthless lot. They really had no value to the nation at all. And this is in one of the pastor's homes in a little tiny village. And the cupboard that was here had a lower shelf that when you took all the dishes off and lifted the shelf, he could go into a tunnel that led several yards out into a field where there's a lot of small trees and hedges. And he came out there so that when the army marched in or the troops came in to arrest the pastor first and put him in prison or question him, then he could simply go out the tunnel and be safe. This is one of the most fascinating cities that I ever saw. They had false stairways that went up, or stairways that went up to a door. You opened the door and rushed in, you fell about 20 feet. They had dead end halls. It was amazing. We had to have a guide who showed us through this place, lest we get lost and accidentally open the wrong door. This minted what we would call tokens. And these are some of the tokens that were minted on this little machine that you saw. The purpose of these tokens was this. These people could assemble, but they couldn't have preaching. They had laws passed that a family of three could actually read their Bible in their own home. But more than three constituted a congregation, so you couldn't open the Bible and discuss it. So these people went into the hills and into the forest and worshiped. But they were always fearful that there would be a spy in their midst who would remember names and places and report them to the inquisitor. So they devised this system of printing, or these are metal, pressing these coins. And on a given Sunday that they were going to meet in worship, the men in the church would circulate and tell them which coin to bring for that particular worship service. And then when they got to the worship service, they passed what we would call the offering plate. And everybody put a coin or token into that offering plate. And then someone sat down and made sure that all the coins that were there were the number of people who were in attendance. But if someone hadn't placed the right token for the right day, then they'd just all get up and go home. They wouldn't have a worship service. This is one of the ancient cities. You may have heard a little song about it. It's on the Rhone River. It's the French city of Avignon. And I think there's a little song that goes with this that everybody learns in kindergarten, I think. Just about everybody does. But this is where the Pope was taken in 1309. And he was in the French captivity. Now, Rome was being sacked. It had been sacked two or three times. And it was in terrible shape. And there was chaos. There were about three popes at one time, each one excommunicating the other. And the French were very powerful. So they went to Rome and brought the Pope and put him in this city here. This city was built for the Pope, this area here. And he was there until 1309 to 1377. And it's a time of chaos, and they don't really like to talk about this much at all. But this is the Pope's bedroom, and this is on the ceiling over his bed, and that's John the Baptist being beheaded. And I often wondered how he interpreted that, since he had ordered many people to be beheaded or punished. This is the hall where people came to propose certain things for themselves, ask for favors, or to ask to be appointed an archbishop or over a city. The archbishops and bishops of larger cities was just like a franchise for Kentucky Fried. You had to buy it from the Pope. And if you took money and a letter from the king and things of this nature, you could get a pretty high-paying job for all your life as the archbishop of some large city or the bishop of a fairly good-sized town. You were set for life, but it cost you to get it. So people came here to this hall, and, this is the door to getting into the castle. You can see there's a little door in the middle, and that's called the thread needle, okay? But here's where people came, and the pulpit, see this little little balcony up here? The Pope would come and stand there, and people could plead their cause before him, and that's where he was available to emissaries from a king or queen or wealthy people. And here's where the doctrine of the infallibility of the Pope began. It was not made an official doctrine until late in the 1700s, and they made it that he spoke infallible only when he was seated on his seat in Rome in the St. Peter's Cathedral in Rome. He was infallible only when he sat there and spoke. And his word can start a new doctrine like the Mary being immaculately conceived. See, she couldn't give birth to Jesus if she herself had the sin nature. So they went back to her being born, where her conception in her mother's womb was immaculate, so that she would not have the sin nature, so that she could bear the child Jesus, so that he wouldn't have a sin nature. That's the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. I'm going to let Betty tell you about this, because this is her favorite story that we saw on this trip. Betty, stand up and tell people what's happening.
This is a temple that was erected for the worship of a false god or goddess. And I remembered the New Testament story when Caesar Augustus decreed that all the world should be taxed. Mary and Joseph went to Bethlehem to register for their taxation. This temple was built around 7 to 9 AD. So to me, when Jesus fled, or Mary and Joseph fled with Jesus to Egypt to protect him from his own king, Herod, who sought to take his life, around this same time frame, Caesar Augustus was using the funds which possibly came from the Jewish people, tax monies that came into the coffers of Caesar Augustus, was used to build this temple for false worship in honor of his two grandsons whom he took to be sons.
Thank you. Now, there was no idol worship or worship of a god or goddess that took place in this temple. That's generally a misunderstanding. This was simply where it was kept and brought out on special days into the open and sat on the porch. And then the people gathered all around outside and paid homage and worship, because that's too small for people to go in and have a worship service or a special service. And you can see that this is one of the best kept remaining temples in the world as far as the Greek and Roman gods and goddesses are concerned. You could go in privately, but they didn't go in and have a public service until they brought it out and displayed it. Here was the cathedral, the Colosseum, which was used at that particular time for people who were brought in and used for the entertainment, as they too were pitted against one another or against wild animals or whatever. It's still used today for bullfights. It's an amazing thing that these things have lasted so very, very long. The last group of people I want to talk to you about is the people who were simply refused to accept the idea that of papal infallibility. They were people who believed you were saved through faith in Jesus Christ. They were Calvinists primarily. not necessarily Huguenots, but they identified with the Huguenots. And this is a place where they took the people that they caught and put in prison. This is the Tower of Constance. It's near Nimes in southern France. And this lady is Marie Durand. She's about 52 years old here. And she was 16 years old when she was taken into this prison. The reason she was put in prison is because her father was a dissenting preacher, and she was engaged to a man who was his assistant. They were finally captured, in trying to capture them. They thought they could imprison her and get them to give themselves up. She insisted that her father and the one she was to marry not come and give themselves up. So she stayed there from being 16 years old, and I think she was finally allowed to leave when she was 56. And every day on this, see, the food, she's in a tower, which is pretty high up, probably 25 feet from the floor here in the floor of this tower down to where people came in. So he had to go up a very narrow stairway. But this grate wasn't there. They rolled this stone over, but they'd roll it back, and they would let utensils down so that these people who were in the tower could be fed. So they waited sitting around this curb in the floor in the middle of the building, and Marie Durand took some item of metal that she had, and she scratched in the surface of this little curb, "I resist." And that became her mantra. It became what she said and the way she lived. "I resist. I will not tell anyone where my father or where my betrothed is." And that became a very popular name in World War II, the resistance movement. And they use this type of history to show that people could resist hard times until the enemy could be defeated. It is by the people who showed us the tower. They said that she sat here on a little near this opening and put her hands on these iron bars, and at that time watched children play out in the meadow. Of course, there's this canal there now that went out, actually crossed a lot of lowland into a river near the mouth of the river, ran into the ocean. But she sat there and looked out. That was her whole life, other than when she was visiting with her loved one, just by shouting down through this opening. What I wanted you to gather from this entire presentation was that we have enjoyed the benefits that were earned by the shedding of blood by these people. And there was not a free church in the sense of being free from the state, where you had absolute liberty, not even in England, until the United States had a Declaration of Independence, and then they drew up our Constitution, and then 2 years later adopted the first 10 amendments, which we call the Bill of Rights. And that Constitution, that Bill of Rights, guarantees to us that we can meet here without the government interfering, without buying a license, without buying a permit, without registering down at the county seat, that we don't have to keep a record of our newborns and to certify that they have been baptized by an Episcopal or Anglican priest or Catholic priest. We don't have any of this trappings, none of this whatsoever. And so I think we just don't realize how wonderful it is to have freedom of conscience and freedom to worship. It's an amazing gift that comes from God, but not many governments have ever let us have the freedom that we have today. Now, in America, they would not even open up any kind of ambassadors or anything with the Roman Empire, the Holy See, that is the 9 acres that combined where the Pope lives. We didn't send a representative, and we wouldn't have one of their representatives sent. And the reason was that the founders of America knew who had created so many problems in Europe. They had been to Europe. Benjamin Franklin, all these people had been to Europe. Many of them come from England. So they knew they wanted to be free from the tyranny of a state-supported church. And I'll give you that story, I think, next Wednesday night. Yes. And then we'll have a business meeting where you can vote my pay and everything for doing all this. But that'll be the last time. But it is just the end, starting about 1600, when Baptist people began to get some freedom. They were the first group of people that ever articulated freedom of conscience were the Baptist preachers in England in the middle 1500s. The first pamphlets ever printed that still exist, arguing for freedom of conscience, that no man has a right to control another man's conscience. Only God should control our conscience, and only God should judge our worship. We do have some circumstances now. I believe that, if I'm not mistaken, $3 billion was in the stimulus package for nonprofit organizations for the 2010 budget in America. And those $3 billion are to be used by people who have after-school projects for children, who mentor children, et cetera, et cetera. And much of this $3 billion will go to churches. Started actually under the Bush administration early, and because he had been helped in his election by so many churches, and he allotted money, this opened the door, and now it has grown from that time, like I think $200 million initially, until now I believe the figure is $3 billion. So if the government puts money into your church for an operation, guess what happens? What happened to Citibank? What happened to GM, General Motors? Do they say what goes on? That's how we will find ourselves in the same situation that people have been in for a long, long time, because they're going to look at your books to make sure you spend it as you should. If some pastor gets in his pulpit, and today they passed hate speech legislation. Now, I can stand in my pulpit and talk about the Bible condemning homosexuality and lesbianism, but the only way I can do it and keep from being arrested is if I don't say it in hateful. So they can judge whether I'm hateful or not. Does any man know my heart? So they're going to have the hate police that's going to be looking everywhere to see if these people, gender, sex, are ethnic. But it's all protected from hate speech. I don't know how they're going to reconcile that with what Jesus, with what Paul wrote, "For whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth." Now, I guess God chastens people out of hate. If he does, he'll go to jail. But I don't know how they'll know whether God's chastening people out of hate or love. It's going to be tough on those 9 old men like me. That's our Supreme Court. Folks, the door's open. I'm not predicting doom. I'm just telling you, if the Lord doesn't come back, we will progress into a situation when we, as an independent group of people, will be watched. How we discipline our children will be watched. How we speak will be watched. Whether we criticize, as I did tonight, the Catholic Church, that would be hate speech. And under this law, I could be arrested and tried. We don't know whether the law is constitutional or not, but there's some things I never thought would be declared constitutional by the Supreme Court that have been.